This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Last week, a Texas grand jury indicted three political associates of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, charging them with illegally raising corporate campaign contributions for a Texas political action committee DeLay founded. DeLay says he's in the clear. Prosecutors say the investigation continues. The House Ethics Committee is also looking into DeLay's involvement in a bitterly contested redistricting battle in the Texas legislature. My guest journalist Lou Dubo says it shouldn't surprise anybody that DeLay's aggressive tactics have drawn scrutiny. Dubose is a veteran Texas journalist who's covered DeLay's rise from being an upstart Republican legislator to holding one of the most powerful posts in Congress. He argues that under DeLay's leadership, the House has become a less democratic institution. His book about DeLay with co-author Jan Reed is called The Hammer. We invited Tom DeLay and House Speaker Dennis Hastert to appear on the program, but we've not yet been able to schedule an interview. I spoke to Lou Dubose last week. Well, Lou Dubose, welcome to Fresh Air.
Glad to be with you.
Tell us a bit about Tom DeLay's background. What kind of family did he come from?
Tom DeLay's kind of a classic American success story in the sense that he comes from this hard-bitten Texas border town close to Laredo, a company town, oil company town, a dysfunctional family, alcoholic father, kicked around the oil fields in Texas, kicked around the oil fields around the world, and in Venezuela. And comes back to goes to the university to Baylor University, and gets in some trouble there. Ends up at the University of Houston, sort of a blue collar place, and ends up in the bug business. He's an exterminator in the 80s. He's an exterminator in Houston, in the suburbs of Houston, in Sugarland. And there's a kind of a Mr. Smith goes to Washington quality about the story. By which he runs for office. He's in a small Republican club. They're handicapping races and looking for a place to win in a state that's completely dominated by Democrats in the 1980s. Every statewide office in both legislative upper and lower house of the legislature, and they nominate him as the one to run. He's the one to run because he has a real passion for the office, because the EPA has just banned Myrex, with which he's been killing ants, a bioaccumulative pesticide that causes all sorts of health problems, and he goes to war against regulation. And that war against regulation was his signature mark in the Texas legislature, where no one really took him seriously. He was one of a small group of Republicans at the time.
How is he remembered in the Texas legislature?
Well, you know, as a bit of a joke. There were very few Republicans then, and Tom DeLay was a guy at the back mic who would make speeches, and people would cheer, "DeLay, DeLay," the legislators would cheer, because he was not a good speaker, one, and because there was always one topic, and the topic was deregulation. He's also remembered as Hot Tub Tom, from who lived in an apartment known as Macho Manor, with several legislators.
Now, wait a minute.
I've got
to interrupt you. Macho Manor, was that the name of the apartment house?
That was the name, that was the designated name of the house that he rented. Because the four guys who lived there, it was a well-known party house with a big hot tub, and the Texas legislature is a big party at times. It's 180 days to every other year, and Tom DeLay was a part of it. He was not a player. However, having said that, Tom DeLay was faithfully committed to one ideal, and that's the ideal that there's too much government regulation. And most of his speeches and his fights were about deregulation.
When did Tom DeLay become a religious person?
That was an important moment in his life, because it provided the focus that I think that made him the power that he is today, and he's the most powerful member in the House of Representatives. You know, he's admitted to a number of writers, and we'll talk about it openly, that, you know, he showed up in Washington as a hard drinking man. You know, he was still Hot Tub Tom from Macho Manor, and Washington offered what he said 10 to 12 martinis a night, which seems like a lot of drinking, and he went into Frank Wolf's office in 1985, the year after he was elected to the House.
Now, who was Frank Wolf?
Frank Wolf's a Virginia congressman who's still there. And who, interestingly enough, at the moment is investigating two of Tom DeLay's associates in an Indian gaming lobby scandal. But Frank Wolf is a Christian conservative from Virginia. He invited Tom DeLand. He invited DeLand to his office, and he told him he'd seen the way he was living, and it was pretty dissolute, and he ought to consider watching a tape. And he showed him a tape by James Dobson in Focus on the Family, the Colorado evangelical who markets these tapes and does these speeches around the country about religious and family values in particular. So he sees this, today sees this, and he says that he fell to his knees and realized that he'd neglected his family and he had neglected the Lord. And at that moment, he stops drinking and he gives himself over to Christ and is saved. And it provided him the focus that allowed him to stop drinking at night and to focus on his work in the house. It also, was an important moment because it was the moment in 1985 at which the country was becoming much more evangelical. So I'm not suggesting for a moment that there's anything less than unauthentic about Tom DeLay's conversion, but it happened at a moment that the country was converting and the Republican Party in particular was embracing and being really overtaken by Christian conservatives.
It's a lot like George Bush in a way.
Very much. George Bush, the distinction is interesting. George Bush was converted to Christianity by Billy Graham walking around the grounds of Kennebunkport, the family compound in Maine, where Billy Graham came and ministered to him personally. Tom DeLay got it retail on television, on a TV tape from James Dobson. But both men who converted at about the same time, it provided them the sort of focus and cleared these. It's kind of like a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. You draw a line across your financial future and everything you did wrong is behind you. You draw a line here against your past. Behind your past, and everything that you did wrong is behind you. And that's what this did for them. I mean, this was a new beginning for Bush and DeLay at about the same time.
Now, DeLay came to Congress in 1984 with the Republican tide that swept Ronald Reagan into a second term. And then, I guess, 10 years later, he ascended to the leadership when he ran against Newt Gingrich's candidate for the Republican whip position and won. How did this guy successfully contend for a leadership position within the Republican caucus?
Well, here is where the tale of Tom DeLay really begins. He did it the way that modern political power is accumulated, through raising money and controlling political action committees, PACs, and distributing that money to members of the House, to candidates for House races. Comes the election, and he spends probably $750,000 on Republican candidates in the 1994 election. And this was before the election, and DeLay went out and didn't just waste his money. He raised money, and he spent it very wisely, and he created something of a candidate school. He said, I want to be these guys, a brother to each one of them. When they needed money, he had money. When they needed videos on how to run a campaign, he had videos.
Now, we're talking in this case about Republicans who want to run for Congress, and he finds these guys and gives them money, support, advice.
Right. He almost created a candidate school for these Republicans. And not only that, but he later admitted that, and a lobbyist admitted that he was going to lobbyists and saying, we need to get some money. These candidates would call his DeLay's personal political consultant, who was running his PAC, which is called ARMPAC, Americans for a Republican Majority. They would call the consultant, ask for money, and if they didn't have enough money in the PAC, they would call a lobbyist. Well, DeLay later said that he had moved about $2 million in lobby money from the lobby to his selected candidates. He traveled to 25 states, so that when the Republicans won that election. This is the big election of 94, the class of 94 that has shaped the modern House of Representatives. When they won that election, Tom DeLay was, many of these, he was venerated by many of the young conservatives who came into power. So Newt's candidate, Gingrich, of course, was going to be Speaker because he had led the revolution. Gingrich picked his close friend and confidant, Bob Walker, to be Majority Whip. And it was assumed that DeLay would lose to Walker because he was running against Gingrich's candidate. He won. He won because of the loyalty that was engendered by this investment of time and money in this class of 94, which remains his power base until this day, although he's expanded it.
You write in the book, Lou Dubose, that no member of Congress had ever raised money the way Tom DeLay did. And you described how he raised a ton of money, used that to back candidates he wanted, which then formed the power base he needed within the Congress, the people, the members who would elect him to majority positions, leadership positions. You also write that as he became the majority whip of the House, he transformed the relationship between lobbyists and lawmakers. What do you mean?
You know, lobbyists, Democrats tend to shun them, liberal Democrats even more, but they are the fourth branch of government. What Tom DeLay did with what is called his K Street Project was he put the lobby to work in the service of the Republican leadership where they are today. The best example of how this was done was in 1998, of how egregious this sort of assault on the lobby was, or the domestication of the lobby on K Street. You know, K Street being the stretch of buildings in the K Street in Washington where many lobby firms are located. In 1998, the Republican leadership in the House put out the word that they would no longer be dealing with Democratic lobbyists or lobbyists who had been affiliated with the Democratic Party. You know, the Democrats had been in power for 40 years, so it was time for some adjustment. But in 94, they started to talk about it. In 95, Tom DeLay starts calling people into his office, and calling lobbyists into his office, and Dave Marinus and Michael Weisskopf of the Post got inside this story, and it was one of the last times DeLay would let reporters close to him and watch it unfold. They started calling lobbyists in, corporate lobbyists, and saying, "We have here the list of your contributions. See, you're in the book. This is literal. You're in the book," as DeLay is telling them. "Here are your contributions to Republican candidates. They're not sufficient. Look how you're contributing to Democrats. That has to stop." Well, the message got out that if you didn't contribute to the Republican Party, you wouldn't have access to the Republican leadership in the House.
So what DeLay was doing was telling lobbyists, you have to quit donating to Democrats. You have to contribute more to Republicans, thereby undermining political support for Democrats and creating lobbyists in Washington representing interests who supported and only dealt with Republicans.
Right.
He got into a fight where he played a role directly in effect, picking an industry lobbyist, right, this in 1998.
Well, we're in 1998, to really send a message to the lobby, Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich, this is the Republican House leadership, pulls a bill from the House floor, an international copyright bill that had been in the works for 2 to 3 years and was only lacking a House vote before it could be moved onto the president's desk to be signed. They pulled it from the floor because the electronics industry had hired a Democratic lobbyist, Dave McCurdy. You know, the bill ultimately got passed, but the idea that they would take a public act on the floor of the House of Representatives and stop the passage of an important piece of legislation that the entire business community was behind was a powerful signal to the lobby that this is a new Congress, and you're going to play ball with us, not just with us, but for us, or you're not going to play at all. It was followed by a rare act by the House Ethics Committee, which hasn't acted in years. In 7 years, it hasn't taken up a complaint. It acting on its own, without a complaint being filed, the House Ethics Committee issued a reprimand to Tom DeLay, and which has never been released. DeLay refuses to release that letter, but it also issued a summary to the entire House saying that they could not take such acts on the floor. They couldn't take a government act on behalf of a partisan client. It was a rare moment of insight into what actually happened in Washington, and it was a powerful signal to the lobby. And the Ethics Committee is pretty much toothless.
Did the bill pass because DeLay got the Ethics Committee letter, or was it that the industry got wise and did the right thing?
No, I think, that's an interesting question. The industry didn't get wise. It stuck with Dave McCurdy, but it did get wise in hiring a Republican lobbyist to work with him. And Dave McCurdy is the big picture guy, and the Republican lobbyist is a former Republican House staffer who works the issues on the floor, works bills on the floor with Republican members. So the issue, they found a way to get out of the corner into which they backed themselves, industry did, and the bill passed.
Now, I think a lot of listeners and a lot of Americans wouldn't have enormous sympathy for lobbyists in Washington. I mean, they see them as people who represent, you know, special interests, spreading money around and often misleading lawmakers or writing bills they shouldn't be getting involved with. Why should anybody worry about lobbyists being browbeaten by Tom DeLay? What's the concern about the democratic process here?
I think the concern is that Majority Leader DeLay has now employed, essentially, or has now intimidated the corporate lobby in such a way that it works for him. There are incidents, one lobbyist from K Street told me that an entire group of several hundred lobbyists was called into a basement meeting at the Capitol and told that you're here today because you're the best lobbyist in town and also because you're loyal Republicans and your job is to pass the president's tax bill. No questions can be asked about content. The bill was not written yet. We want this bill passed on the first day. So essentially what you have is the tail wagging or perhaps whipping the dog. The lobbyists are now working for the Republican part, the Republican leadership in the House, which gives the leadership enormous power.
Well, you write a good bit about how the operation of Congress has changed under the current Republican leadership. How has it developed?
Enormous concentration of power in the hands of those at the top. The Gingrich Revolution was in part about taking power away from committee leaders and placing that power in the hands of the leadership. So what they did was they put term limits on committee chairs of 6 years. And that's about the time it takes to learn to run a committee in Washington, particularly a complex committee, say like the House Energy Committee, that just where Billy Tozen, the Louisiana congressman, just left. There's much less power in the hands of the committee staff. They also slash committee staffs substantially, so that the committees that used to draft legislation are now far more dependent on lobbyists, and the lobbyists have kind of filled the void and draft legislation for committees. The speaker has much more presence at committee meetings, and the leader. The leadership will often send people to committee meetings and watch over what's happening, as they never did before.
Let me just cut in here. I mean, at least Democrats are at the committee meetings, right? So you have a bipartisan input into legislation, don't you?
In theory, Dave, but actually, DeLay's staff and DeLay himself has described Democrats as being marginal and irrelevant. Committees are now really bifurcated, and the work is done more often than not by small task forces or by the majority staff of the committee, that is the Republican staff, ignoring the Democrats in a way that the Democrats never quite did while they were in the majority for 40 years, although they were not above abusing their power. But the committee decisions are made by the committee majority. Then the entire committee will convene, and there will be a committee vote in which the Democrats protest and the Republicans on the committee pass the bill, and it reports out to the floor. Voting is curtailed. The Congress votes 2 days a week. The House meets roughly two and a half days a week. So there are no debates anymore. There are these sort of set pieces about these bills in which everyone states how they feel about it, but the outcome is predetermined. It's much more they being the leadership. And the leadership really is Tom DeLay. Tom DeLay put Denny Hastert into office in 1998.
Now he's the House Speaker.
Speaker Hastert. Dennis Hastert was Tom DeLay's deputy whip. He ran his whip's campaign. He ran DeLay's whip campaign. So essentially he put his lieutenant, and he named his lieutenant to be his boss. And there is a much more parliamentary procedure to the Congress by which Republicans know that they cannot vote against their leadership. And they don't.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is Texas journalist Lou Dubose, who's the co-author with Jan Reed of a new book about Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. The book is called The Hammer, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. You describe in a book the drafting and voting of the Medicare reform bill, which had the Republican prescription drug plan. You say that the actual drafting and debate of this measure was done in a closed caucus, closed to Democrats, and closed to the public, and closed to the media.
Right. Entirely by accident, a reporter from the provinces in Texas walked into the Republican caucus. And this is well known, but you generally don't get to see it. The bill had been already drafted in subcommittee, in committee by Republicans. And the Republicans were meeting, and they had brought in Newt to talk about how important this was. And they were telling their members that they could not vote against this bill. That a vote against this bill was a vote against the party and a vote against the president, and that if they voted against this bill, they would end up like the Democrats. They would end up in the minority position where they'd been for 40 years. And Tom DeLay sat and watched as the bill was being whipped. They emerged with a consensus. And even then, there were some conservative Republicans who bolted and tried to vote against the bill. This is the piece of legislation that passed after 3 hours on the House floor. Now, the House keeps votes open for 15 minutes. This passed just before, in November, just before 6 in the morning, after a three-hour vote on the House floor, in which Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert, the Speaker, worked the floor. The President was making phone calls. And finally, they got their vote at the end of the, almost at the third hour, and they closed the vote and prevailed. An unprecedented event in the House of Representatives.
Now, maybe you should explain, when you say keep a vote open, what do you mean for listeners?
Yeah, well, a clock runs on a vote. When there's a quorum call, then there's a call to vote, a clock is turned on, and at the end of 15 minutes, you've either voted or you haven't, and the vote is closed. You know, sometimes they're pushed to 17. The Democrats would be abusive and push them to 20, to 22. But there was never anything like 3 hours. And a three-hour vote in the dark, in the wee hours of the morning, ending at just before 6 o'clock with Barney Frank sputtering, what's happened here, he was demanding a point of parliamentary inquiry. It was unprecedented. And that 3 hours was three hours of Tom DeLay strong-arming members on the floor of the House. There was also an allegation that Nick Smith was offered a $100,000 bribe in order to secure his vote. Nick Smith is a congressman who is a Republican congressman who is retiring, and the next day he said he was offered $100,000 for his son's campaign, and he was warned that there would be punitive action taken against his son if he didn't vote for the prescription benefit bill.
Was there any action taken as a result of that allegation?
You know, that is still pending before the House Ethics Committee. And an interesting thing about the House Ethics Committee is that there has been a truce. For 7 years, no Democrat or no Republican has filed a complaint before the House Ethics Committee because there's an understanding that if you don't file against us, we won't file against you. The first complaint was filed last year by Chris Bell, a Texas Democrat who lost his seat as a result of Tom DeLay's coming into the state and redrawing the district lines.
Most city councils, state legislatures have rules which are designed to ensure that the public has input into the drawing up of legislation. You know, bills have to be introduced in public. There has to be a public hearing at which interested citizens can make their voices heard. Votes have to be in public, and it's designed to ensure that it all occurs in the open, that sun shines on the process, you know, and that all interested parties at least have their say, if not their way. Why are you saying that just doesn't happen in the United States House of Representatives anymore?
It does in appearance. I mean, there are these committee hearings that are sort of set pieces, but the decisions are made in the caucus, in the Republican House conference, and the decisions are made by Republicans on the committee. And there is a pro forma process of protesting if you're a public citizen and attending a hearing, or if you're a lobbyist that's shut out of the system attending a hearing. But it's pretty much a closed system, and this is not just our theory, but it's pretty well understood among congressional scholars in Washington.
One of the ways that that the leadership is so effective is by the discipline it imposes on members when an important vote occurs. And you write that Tom DeLay, when he held the Republican whip position, was very, very effective in getting legislation through. Give us an example of how he was able to get his members to vote his way.
I think the best example, Dave, is what happened in 1998 with the Clinton impeachment. It was an extraordinary moment in American history. The president was about to be impeached, and the consensus of the House was not to impeach the president of the United States. A better prospect was what was called censure plus, and everyone, a majority of the of both parties had agreed that censure plus, censuring Bill Clinton plus, you know, docking his retirement for so many years, taking his bar card away from him, some sort of punishment. DeLay would not let that happen. He took this particular moment, he sees this particular moment as his own. You have to go back and remember that Newt Gingrich was resigning because of because they had, the Republicans had lost 22 seats in the election before that. They had miscalculated and lost seats. Bob Livingston had been designated speaker by Tom DeLay. Bob Livingston was revealed by Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler, that Bob Livingston had had extramarital affairs, and he resigned. Gingrich was gone as a power, and Livingston was gone as a power. Hastert was in office, and DeLay was in charge. Tom DeLay threatened people, threatened specific members that he would take their chairs away from them. He sent an aide to Peter King, a Northeastern liberal, and told him if you don't vote to impeach the president, the next 2 years are going to be the most difficult years of your life.
How would he make his life difficult?
He would never get a bill passed. He would never get a hearing of a bill. He would be utterly marginalized. So here you had the speaker, the de facto speaker of the House. Tom DeLay was then and probably still is the de facto speaker of the House, although there's some debate about that. Here you had the de facto speaker of the House setting up a war room, staffing the war room, with his own aides, and sending out blast faxes to 100 television and radio stations a day. And I'd like to take one little segment of that. In that, the sort of the book that gives you a sense of what the war room was.
Now we're talking, just to clarify for listeners, we're talking about Tom DeLay setting up kind of an operations center to drive the impeachment of President Clinton.
Right, and he called that center, they designated this center the war room, and he had all of his staff was dedicated to the impeachment of the president because the House didn't want to do it. You know, Democratic bodies look for an equilibrium, and equilibrium was not what the impeachment of the president for lying about sex was about.
You believe that Bill Clinton would not have been impeached were it not for this obsessive drive on the part of Tom DeLay?
I mean, the House, Lanny Davis was Bill Clinton's lawyer who had left the White House staff, and he was talking to a lot of reasonable Republicans at the time who were in the House at the time, John McCain, Bill McCollum, who just ran for Senate in Florida and lost, Lindsey Graham, who's now in the Senate, and these guys were saying, "Let's cut a deal and let's get out of this constitutional impasse." Bob Livingston, while he was Speaker designate, sat down before he resigned from a position he never quite got to. Speaker elect, he sat down and said, "My God, we're about to impeach the President of the United States. We've got to stop this." All the momentum in the House was moving away from it, and there was a consensus and a majority not to do it. Tom DeLay was insistent that Bill Clinton be impeached, and he prevailed. He prevailed by using the really crudest methods he broke the last 20 arms and made sure the Republican Party, the Republican members of the House, enough of them voted to impeach.
We're back with Lou Dubos. He is the author of The Hammer, with his co-writer Jan Reed. It's a biography of Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. The redistricting battle in the state of Texas last year, that is to say the redrawing of congressional banners, made headlines with lawmakers hiding out in motels across state lines. But it's generated a major constitutional battle and a whole lot of trouble for Tom DeLay and some of his associates. This began, I guess, with Tom DeLay deciding he had to get more members of Congress from Texas, but to do that, he had to take over the Texas State House first, right?
Right, which the Republicans had not been able to do since Reconstruction, is the cliche, 130 years. You know, this is the other end of the arc of character of Tom DeLay. This is here. Mr. Smith comes to Washington to fight deregulation, and that was 20 years ago. That was in 1984. Now he's facing several investigations. And his top aides have been indicted by a Texas grand jury here in Austin. What happened was, in 2001, he and Jim Ellis, an aide of his who had run his arm pack, his big funding combine, Jim Ellis and Tom DeLay were actually driving around in Texas brainstorming about how they could take over the state house, because the house was the only thing that was stopping the state congressional lines from being redrawn to benefit Republican legislators, congressmen. So they decided they would replicate in Texas what they had done with RMPAC in Washington, raise a huge amount of money, invest it specifically, target elections that they could win and win the state house, then appoint a speaker, or see that a speaker was appointed who would go along with their proposal to redraw the state's congressional districts to pick up 5 to 7 seats for the Republican Party in the state in the U.S. Congress. You know, Tom DeLay was very frank about this. He said, "I'm the majority leader. I want more seats." He presided over the entire affair, but what they did wrong, and it seems like they clearly broke the law, or at least a district attorney in Texas did, was they raised and spent corporate money on elections in Texas.
Now, let's just make the point here. It's interesting to see that when he began raising money for, after all, which were state house seats in communities in Texas, his fundraising arms got checks from corporations far and wide, I mean, all over the country, right?
$100,000 from a nursing home association in Massachusetts, $25,000 from a Kansas City utility, and Westar. This money came pouring in from all over the country, and there was no apparent reason for them to be donating money to Texas House races. A Westar executive, when they were asked for $25,000, they were actually asked for $58,000. When they were asked for $25,000, a Westar executive wrote to another executive, "Tom DeLay's a Texas guy. Why are we doing it?" They were doing it to cultivate favor with the majority leader and the most powerful member of the U.S. Congress. So they spend $1.5 million on 22 House seats, along with the Texas Association of Business that spent about $1.7 on the same 22 House seats. And they elect for the first time in 130 years a Republican House. The speaker who is appointed is an old friend of Tom DeLay's. Tom DeLay is there the day he's sworn in for office. And lo and behold, they begin to talk about redistricting. Now, you know, in fairness to the Republicans, the Democrats have been in control for a long time here, and there did need to be an adjustment of lines to create a more reasonable balance of Democrats and Republicans. But the way in which it was done, in an off-census year, after three judges had drawn the lines because the legislature couldn't do it in 2001, the way in which it was done suggested that it was bought. And that's what brings us to District Attorney Ronnie Earle.
Well, let's get to that. Yeah, I mean, okay. So the District Attorney, Ronnie Earle, has now issued indictments of three people who were involved in this effort. What did they do wrong, according to the indictment?
According to the indictment, what they did wrong was they knowingly raised money from corporations. There was a law passed in 1905 in Texas that makes the spending of corporate money on political campaigns illegal. It was to protect the state from the robber barons, and it was part of a national movement to sort of clean up politics. Ronnie Earle is an interesting character because he's sort of the last man standing in Texas. Because he's the DA in the Capitol, he has statewide prosecutorial authority. So they didn't think he would do it. You know, the Democrats control Republicans control every elected office, statewide office in Texas now. The AG, the Attorney General, is Republican, a former Karl Rove client. So they didn't think that there would be anybody to stop them. And lo and behold, he did. Last week, handing down three indictments of individuals, three top DeLay fundraisers, and eight corporations who contributed money to DeLay's Texas PAC, Trim PAC, which is the PAC that elected the Republican House.
What Tom DeLay has said is, in response to the indictments, is this just emphasizes what I've been saying all along, that this investigation is not about me. I haven't been asked to testify. I haven't been asked to provide any records, and I haven't been asked to come as a witness. Is Tom DeLay in the clear here?
Not at all. This investigation is clearly aimed, in the end, I think, at Congressman Tom DeLay. And the DA will not say that, but he says that anyone, when asked about Tom DeLay, he said anyone who has violated the law in Texas will be a target of the investigation. What's happening is, by calling in these corporate funders who wrote the checks, one of which was written to from the Williams Corporation, an Oklahoma utility gas company, $25,000 check was the salutation said, "Dear Congressman DeLay," enclosed to the $25,000 promised to the fundraiser. Well, by calling these people in, and they're facing prison terms, these three men, each of these three fundraisers are facing prison terms, one up to 99 years, this is a serious prosecution that is looking in the direction of the majority leader of the U.S. House. By a little guy in Washington and in Austin who has four attorneys working for him in a public integrity unit. It was a remarkable moment when the indictments actually came down, because no one thought that that a district attorney in Texas would not only indict three of Tom DeLay's fundraisers, but would also indict eight corporations. So everybody's going to be dragged before a court, and a Texas jury is going to look at out-of-state donors coming into the state and essentially buying elections here. And ultimately, this could lead to Congressman DeLay.
Well, Lou Dubose, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave. It was a pleasure.
Journalist Lou Dubose. His book with Jan Reed is called The Hammer. We invited Tom DeLay and House Speaker Dennis Hastert to appear on the show, but haven't as yet been able to schedule an interview.